My name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
And I got sober on October 12, 1982. I'm grateful to be here and be sober, and I'm grateful to be asked. It's always an honor and a privilege to speak anywhere about anything, anytime, considering, you know, that no one would even let me into their homes a short time ago in my life. You know, if you want to make God laugh, show him your plans, and that was my experience today. A million and one things took place in my home today, the last of which was a reoccurrence of my daughter, my little two-year-old Megan. Our babysitter has three sons, and they pee standing up like this. And occasionally she gets the idea that she's a boy. So the last thing I saw as I left my house was my daughter standing by the toilet. Shooting out the wrong way. Yellow grout. I got yellow grout. And I didn't even say no. And one of the little boys' names is Willie. And she looked at me because my wife said no. And she looked up. She said, "Willie Worm. Megan No Worm." That's right, honey. You stick with me. You'll get out of grade school when you're about 40 if you stick with me. Where'd Marilyn go? There's Marilyn. Marilyn, I got to tell the little story you told me. Marilyn told me a little story a while ago that she put her sweatpants on and rushed out to an AA meeting. And she felt something rolled up by the ankle in her sweats. And so she started unraveling her sweats and started, you know, the meeting was in progress, wasn't it? And she slowly unravels whatever is wrapped up by her ankle, and she pulls out a pair of her underwear and holds them up gay. So the rest of the meeting was on lust. Only in AA, only in the A&A club. I don't know. Happy St. Patrick's Day to all you who are Irish. I didn't ask if you were Irish. Because I'm not that much. I'm part Irish. I think I got a sliver or two in me. And I guess maybe if I was pure Irish, I'd be dead. I don't know. Because it was tough enough making it without being pure Irish. Those Italians, I'm part Italian, too, and we can do our thing, I'll tell you. So I figured we'd start off with an Irish joke. Okay? Okay. A guy goes into a bar, an Irish guy, and he orders three shots and three beers. And he drinks them, and he orders three shots and three beers, and he drinks them, and he orders three shots and three beers, and he drinks them, and he leaves, and he comes back the next day, and he orders three shots and three beers. Finally, the bartender says, "What's with the three shots and three beers?" And he says, "Well, I drink one for myself and one for each of my two brothers in the old country." And he says, "Oh, okay." And he comes back the next day, and he only orders two shots and two beers, and the bartender says, "Oh, my God, I'm sorry. Did one of your brothers die?" And he said, "No, I quit drinking." Classic case of AA denial, alcoholic nature. Well, it's, you know, it's too bad we have to be so serious here today. I've noticed in myself lately, and I don't know if it's because I'm getting sober longer or what, but I'm looking at my sobriety as more of a gift today than I did ever in my life. Maybe it's because of the wonders that have occurred, the miracles that have taken place, the miracles that I see around me. Mary and I were talking earlier how maybe sometimes we can get caught up in life, or I can, and not necessarily forget where I came from, but maybe forget that life's about laughing, and life's about enjoying, and life's about living, but, you know, it wasn't always that way. It wasn't always that way for people like us. We're in a room full of potential homicidal maniacs who have found a way of living that has virtually altered the lives of thousands of people. Thousands and thousands of people have been touched by the sobriety in this room, not just our own lives, but the lives of all of our loved ones. And it wasn't always that way. There wasn't always laughter. And if you're with a loved one in this room who you saw as an active alcoholic, you fully understand what I'm talking about. And it wasn't always that way for me. You know, I only got one story, and a lot of you have heard that story. But it's the only one I got, you know, and it all starts back as far as I can remember with a feeling of not fitting. Just not, plain not fitting. And, you know, I had the experiences that we have sometimes as children, a sense of less than, and, you know, I was one of those kids who had a very difficult time learning, and I think that this shaped my thinking process for years to come. I was told that I had to be put in special classes when I was a little kid, and they told me that the reason I had to be put in special classes and didn't advance as well as everybody else was because I was special. I went to the school on the little bus with all of my special friends, and we sat in the special classes and learned special things that the rest of the kids probably learned 5 years before us. But we could not pick it up. There was something, the wires weren't connecting. Now today they got names for all that stuff. You know, there's ADD and other names, dyslexia and things like that. But back then, you know, you were just special. And I was special, but I wasn't quite that stupid. I mean, I realized that was just a nice way of saying you're light years behind your peers, pal. That's really the problem here. And, you know, you'll probably never catch up, you moron. So just sit and shut up and do what you're told. And that's pretty much, you know, that was pretty much the beginning of the end for me. I remember never fitting. I remember not feeling special. I remember feeling out of place and not feeling like I was part of the deal. And then my education began in the school system, St. Philip Neri in Chicago, and my very first teacher's name was Sister Mary Edward. Sister Mary Edward taught me about God, and Sister Mary Edward was literally 6'3" and had a beard, and was the most frightening, ominous looking, and a wart. She had this wart, and. You know, the one thing I realize today is that maybe Sister Mary Edward didn't teach me what I thought she taught me. What I thought she taught me was about condemnation, fear, and guilt, and punishment. And that had to do with a handful of hair missing out of my head on occasion. Sister Mary Edward could have woven a sweater out of the hair she took out of my head. But, you know, that kind of soured me towards the God thing, sort of made me fear this omnipotent, all-powerful God that I was taught about, or as I perceived myself being taught about. As we all know, we suffer from a disease of perception, and what we view as reality isn't always reality in the real world. But that's where I was, and that's how I felt. And that's how I survived in those early days of my life. I survived by being a chameleon. I survived by faking it till I could make it. I remember anticipating my first drink. I saw the magic of alcohol working in the life of my father. When my father came home from work, and I was a young boy, he came home from work, and he had that smell on his breath. He would play with us and wrestle with us and clown with us, and I knew that there was something special about that smell. And I wasn't certain about what it was or what it did, and I was just a little kid. But, man, when he smelled that way, it was party time in the house, okay? And when he didn't, it was get the hair out of your eyes. Did you do your homework? Sit, finish your vegetables, blah, 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 blah. And it wasn't the same. So I anticipated my first drink, very much so, because I saw that there was something about that was attractive. He took me to bars when I was a little kid. Excuse me, the corned beef and cabbage. And I'm only kidding. And I anticipated that first drink. And let me tell you how my first drink went. I had asked a guy named Jerry, who was a guy I admired. He had muscles in his poop, and he had tattoos all over him. So he was the kind of guy I wanted to grow up to be. Some people want to be doctors and lawyers. I wanted to be a felon. And I asked this Jerry, who was the man, could he procure me a bottle of fine beverage so that I could experience what it was like to drink. In other words, get me a bottle and let me get juiced. And he did. And the events were, he met me at the pool hall, Vise Inn in Lamont, Illinois. We went up on the roof and we began to drink a bottle of MD 2020. And I was 12, I believe. And we drank that bottle, and I felt that warmth, and I felt that feeling come over me. That was the most powerful, bulletproof-type feeling I'd ever experienced in my life, ever. I'd never experienced anything so warm. For the first time in my life, and it was that immediate for me, for the first time in my life, I was in. And you know what I mean. I was in. You weren't better. You weren't better. I was just as good. And I never did take a social drink in my life, to my knowledge, and that was no exception. I got absolutely, totally blitzed. I fell off the roof. I broke my nose. I staggered across Stevens Street. I fell on my face in the middle of the street and cut my cheek. I think I pooped or peed in my pants. I was just a kid. Well, sort of. I staggered across the street. I got to the apartment that was down the street where my folks live. I fell up the stairs. I fell through the screen door into the glass. I broke the glass. I cut my hand. My mom was screaming. My dad was yelling. He was slapping me in the back of the head while she was trying to hug me. She ran the tub. I puked in the tub. There was blood everywhere. I woke up the next day barred from living. You will never live again. You are not allowed to breathe anymore. You'll never leave this house as long as you live, except to go to school. And you're not even allowed to go to the bathroom for, you know, as far as we're concerned. You can't go anywhere. And I woke up with this incredible, absolutely horrible hangover. And I went to school and I said to my friends, you guys got to try this. Alcohol has the properties, and a guy like me, to eliminate, for a period of time when I'm successfully drinking, to eliminate any of the negatives and alter my perception of the reality so thoroughly that all I see and all I want is that feeling of freedom that I got from that drink. I didn't care about the negatives. When I said that to my friends, I meant it. The consequences of my action was not important. The only thing that was important from that day forward was to get that feeling of freedom that I got from that drink. I mean, that was, I'll tell you, that was my mission in life. That was my goal. And it remained my goal for many, many, many years. So I trotted through life that way. And for a long, long period of time, alcohol worked, you know. My buddy Urban has a saying. He says, you know, when the flames of life are burning your ass, it's a bad time to learn the principles of oxidation. And, you know, the flames of life began to burn my butt. And I didn't know any defense. I had no defense against that. I began to do things I didn't want to do to people I didn't want to do them to. I began to hurt people that I loved and I didn't want to hurt them. I began to end up in places I didn't want to be, saying things I didn't want to say. Just common alcoholic experiences. I mean, that was it. I mean, there was no other horizons. There was no other place for me to go. All I knew from that day forward, well into my 20s, was I knew one thing. I knew how to anesthetize myself to not have to live life on life's terms. I don't know what it was about me. You know, I hear that some of us are born without that extra layer of insulation. But there seemed to be a quality about me, not quality, a sense about me that I was cut easily, to the quick, easily. that I hurt easily, that a look would take me apart, that constructive criticism was horrifying. It was painful. How could you explain that to somebody? You know, how do you explain to your father who's trying to teach you math and he doesn't know, you know, he doesn't realize that you're trying as hard as you can try, and he's breaking pencils, and he's getting so frustrated with you, and you know that you can't get it. You know you can't. Okay? But some about that interaction with people in my life cut me so deeply. And I really believe that only alcoholics understand that experience. And I don't mean in that just that context. I mean in life in general. I mean, you know, we can still sit in AA meetings sober and have someone, maybe someone's having a bad day and they're sitting there like this at the table and you happen to glance at them and you think, what the hell's his problem? What's he giving me that look for? You know, then I kill him in my sleep over and over and over again. And the reality is there seems to be some kind of wiring didn't get connected in me. And I can't put a finger on it, don't care to. All I know is that the one thing that is a fact in my life is alcohol worked, and it worked well, and it worked for a long time. And quite frankly, I had a hell of a lot of good times drinking. And I am not one who blows the horn of righteousness or tells anyone what they should do or what they shouldn't do. I had a lot of good times drinking. But those good times turned into horror over a period of years. And it can't be a good thing, you know, as alcoholism progressed in me. I remember driving down to Wilmington, Illinois, seeing this guy who'd pick up cans, who lived in his vehicle, and he'd pick up cans to buy alcohol. That's all he did. He was a bum. And I drove down to Wilmington, Illinois, and hid out at this trailer that this girl had that I met. And I hid out there, and I'd see that guy picking up these cans on the frontage road, and I'd think to myself, that guy's got it made. He's got it made. He picks up his cans. He goes and buys his booze. Doesn't bother anyone. No one bothers him. There's no conflict. He gave up on life. The conflict is when we don't give up on life. The conflict is when that is still in us, that there's a spark that remains in us that does not want to die. There's this conflict, this spark that says, you know, there's got to be more than this. There must be more than this. This can't be all there is. And that's the conflict. You know, I say this so that non-alcoholics might understand their alcoholic partner a little better, and I also say it because it is so true in my case. In my alcoholic career of drinking, I made 1,001 promises. Do you know how many of those promises I truly wanted to keep? 1,001 of them. I stood in the foyer of that house crying to that woman I married that I will never do that again. And you know what? The next day I did it again. The killer is, for me, that when I said I'd never do it again, I meant it. I truly meant it, that I would never do that to her again. And I would be home the next night with the paycheck. And I would never abandon you again. And I would never hurt you again. Okay? And the next day I'm out getting a gallon of milk on a moped and I end up at the Bratstop in Wisconsin. I mean, how the hell does that happen? It doesn't happen to normal people. You know? And that is what kills us, I think. Kills me. Is that I had the capacity to love, even as a drunk. I had the capacity to have compassion and care as a drunk. I had the capacity to feel those things. The problem was I didn't have the capacity to act out on those things. I didn't have the capacity to show that love. I could love, but not be able to show it in a consistent manner. I wanted to be responsible, but didn't have the capacity to be consistently responsible. I had the capacity to say to her, I love you, I never want to do that to you again, and I won't, and mean it, and do it again and again and again. And that is the killer for me. That's it. That's what makes me want to cap myself. The one common denominator I have found in alcoholics like me, the one emotion that will kill me before all other emotions is guilt. That's it. Guilt. And I'll tell you, I tried to drink guilt away for an entire 27-year period of my life. Well, you know, from the time I started drinking. And for a while I could do it. It altered my perception of the reality so wonderfully that I didn't have to deal with life on life's terms. And then eventually, what alcohol once did for me, the isms it once relieved, the emotions it once seemed to thin out and make okay, it began to intensify those very same emotions. Instead of being less afraid, I began to get more afraid. Okay? Instead of having less inhibitions, I began to become very inhibited. I began to become very much the chameleon because I began to fear what everybody thought of me. I began to get paranoid, really. When alcoholism starts taking you, me, I'm telling you, for me, it was a quick progression down to Nowheresville, okay? And that period in my life is very skewed. And the memories of that period are very skewed. I was dating a girl, and this girl I credit with helping save my life. She decided that she was going to go to Al-Anon. Because there was something abnormal about the way I drank. Slightly. And she did. She went to Al-Anon. And they said, you know, you won't be able to change him, but maybe you can change yourself. And she said, well, is there any AA literature or something I could kind of get him, you know? And they said, yeah. And so we had that little trailer out on this lake in Wilmington, Illinois. And what she did was she began to strategically plant AA literature all around this trailer. All around in every area that she thought I would find it, everywhere from my tackle box to in the pillowcase, you know, when I'd lay my head down, it'd be crinkling, and the pièce de résistance was she put the merry-go-round of denial pamphlet in the toilet paper roller, and it came flying out as I went to wipe, you know. And so, you know, she kept asking me, do you think maybe you are one? And I continued to deny that fact. Denial is part of the game. You know, I'm like the fly on the windowsill. We've all seen the fly on the windowsill. The window is closed. And the fly is, you know, he's determined that he's going to break through that glass and get out the window. And then one day you look for the fly and he's laying dead on the windowsill. The door was open, right? And I had about the brains of a fly. The door was open, but I just, you know, you're not, I'm my way or the highway, baby, till death do I part. And so anyway, you know, all this literature was buried all over the place. And finally, you know, the bottom that I experienced in my act of alcoholism was something that was extremely painful and remains extremely difficult to recapture. There was a lot of events that occurred during my drinking, one of which I hid from almost to death, which was my nephew. Most of you heard that story, but I share it anyway. To let you know that there is freedom, no matter what happens in your life as a drunk, there's freedom to be had in sobriety. And this little beautiful little boy, Tommy was his name, grew up right here in Lamont, and it was going to be his first year that he was eligible to play Little League Baseball, and he didn't want to play. And that really kind of pissed me off, because that's my nephew. You know, my nephew. The guy who never got out of high school's nephew, who played football for a couple of years and thought he was Al Bundy. And so I bribed this kid and I browbeat this kid and I finally got him, I bribed him, finally, to play baseball. I'd give him X amount for a hit and X amount for a home run. And he said, okay. And he got up to bat in his very first Little League game. And the pitcher threw the ball, and the ball hit him in the chest. And I was standing there with my brother-in-law and my sister, and he fell to his knees. And he got back up for a minute, and then he fell back down, and he died. He died. He dropped, and he died, and he never got up again. And, you know, God, what a time for alcohol to stop working. You know, what a time for alcohol to stop working. I proceeded to attempt to drink myself to death because that was something that I was never going to get over. It was something that I had as a secret. It was his and my secret, and no one knew that we made that little pact, and I knew I killed him. And I knew I killed him. And so as the drinking progressed and I got nearer and nearer, spiraling downward to that bottom, I remember going home, waking everybody up. By then I had nowhere to live, and I was living in a van, and I woke my family up, and my brother was there, and my sister was in from Arizona visiting, and my father and my mother, and they lived in a little apartment. And I said to them, you know, I'm probably going to die this weekend, but if I don't, I'm going to somehow make you proud of me. And with that, my brother, who's a very gentle soul, he's a doctor of psychology, and he's a meditator, and he's one of these tofu-eating, you know. Yeah. You saw that commercial with the soft drink, didn't you, where it's all naturally made from tofu and all this. But he was one of those guys, and he decided he's going to dive over the table and start strangling me to death. He jumped over the table, and as he was strangling me to death, he said to me, "You don't have to die." And I thought, "But you're killing me, you son of a bitch." So you don't have to die. And he cried for 3 days. My mom told me he stayed in his room, and he cried for 3 days over that. He thought he killed me, you know. He thought... because I ran out of that apartment, and he thought he killed me. He thought that was it. And, you know, all this time there was this wacky undertaker living downstairs from them. And his name was Urban G. And I lived in that apartment with my folks for a period of time, and Urban knew I was a prime candidate for the AA club. And he'd see me stagger up the stairs, and I was a brawler. I had stab wounds, and I'd be bloody, and he'd watch me, and he'd watch me come down in the morning. Urban was a giver. He liked to beautify. Wherever he was, he wanted to bring beauty to it. And we lived in this little apartment building. He'd be out there planting flowers, and I'd come down those stairs, and he'd slap me on the back and say, "How you doing, Jim?" And I wanted to kill him so bad. Because he knew how I was doing, but he never ruined an opportunity by shoving AA down my throat. Never. He never did ruin that opportunity by shoving Alcoholics Anonymous down my throat. He was a wise man. And he was part of the plan. You know, after my brother stopped strangling me, I got in the van and I went down for one last trip to Wilmington, Illinois, and I woke up at 2 in the morning in a parking lot with a syringe in my arm and a bottle of scotch between my legs and a .38 in my lap, and I looked out the window as I came to, and for one brief moment, I had a picture of clarity about what I had become. Looking at me was my girlfriend and her mother, and they had a look in their eyes of horror, dismay, and contempt, sort of all rolled into one. They looked at me like, I think they felt the way you feel about a deer that's been hit by a car. And it's in the middle of the road, and it's kicking, and it's struggling, and its legs are broken, and you think to yourself, you know, the best thing for that deer is just to cut its throat and get it out of its misery. And that's kind of how they looked at me. And that was it, you know. That was the bottom. That was the bottom I remember. I'll never forget it. I mean, I was totally annihilated. I had been drunk for 3 straight days, and that moment has stuck with me as if I was stone sober. I mean, the looks on their face have never left me. That seems to be God's gift to Jim. That's what it seems to be today to me. So, you know, the next day, I got on the phone, and I made that phone call. I called that guy, Urban. And I said, "Urb," I said, "I'm dying. and I want to go to AA. And that was on a Sunday, and he had a funeral, the undertaker. He had a funeral going on, and he said, I'm going Tuesday night. I'll pick you up at 7 o'clock. And I said, fine, great. So Monday came along, and my dad and my ma kind of got me back into their house because I called A&A, and they said, you know, we got to do something about him, keep him out of the bar today. So my dad decided, because I love to fish, he decided he's going to take me fishing. So he took me back down to Wilmington, just where I wanted to be, fishing. And on the way there, I said, you know, Dad, I said, I can't imagine living life, the rest of my life, without drinking. And he said to me, he said, the wisest words I'd ever heard to that day. He said, son, you're a Hutchinson. They'll teach you how to drink again in AA. I said, I had no idea, Dad. And quite honestly, I looked forward to the opportunity of learning how to drink like a human being. And, you know, I had envisioned the successful drinker room when you walk into AA, where everyone's in coats and ties. And then there's us beginning drinkers who are still a little sloppy. Now, I'll tell you how God works in my life. I got very sick that Monday afternoon. I began to go through withdrawals, and I began to shake pretty violently, and I was really, you know, I was pretty messy. I had boils on me from alcohol poisoning. I just was a mess. Now, that's not the important part of everything anyway, but I was a mess, and I was getting real sick, and I sat outside of the apartment building that night waiting for Urban to come and get me, and I couldn't take it anymore. And the bar was 2 minutes down the street, the very same bar I got drunk at the first time in my life. And I was going to make it down to that bar, and I was going to drink a half pint of vodka to get the edge off and go to that AA meeting. And it was 10 to 7, and I stood up to go, and Urban come down around the corner 10 minutes early to pick me up for the first AA meeting of my life. And there are no coincidences in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm going to tell you about my experience at my first AA meeting, because to me, it is probably the most profound experience of my lifetime. The importance to me of having the handout to the newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous was brought to life in Technicolor that night. I hadn't felt wanted or loved, not because people didn't want me or love me, but because I shoved them out of my life, but I hadn't felt wanted or loved for a long, long time. Urban took me to my first AA meeting, and there was people virtually surrounding me with their arms around me, telling me that if they could stay sober, I could stay sober, and that I don't have to live like an animal anymore, and that I don't have to be the person I used to be, and that this is truly the first day of the rest of my life, and that I don't have to experience the horror and the nightmare and the hopelessness of alcoholism ever again if I just do what they tell me to do. And I'm telling you, it was nuclear. The feeling I had was nuclear. I went home, and I said to my beautiful mother, who I had said to 100 times before, I'm not going to drink anymore. And she'd always look at me and say, yeah, right, you know, with tears in her big Italian eyes. And I went home that night, and I said to her, I said, I don't think I got to drink anymore. And for the first time ever, she looked at me, and she said, I don't think you do either. I don't think you ever have to live that way again. And every time I think of that, no matter how many times I tell that stinking story, I get stupid like this. I just can't help it. I mean, it's just too profound. Those experiences are too profound to not get touched by them for a lifetime. It doesn't have to go away. I don't have to forget. And it still does it to me, no matter where I am or how many times I talk about those experiences. So those guys and the women, you know, meeting with Lamont Oaks, my first meeting ever, they showed me something that night that was just so powerful, through their acceptance of me, that has stuck with me to this day. Now, the first meeting, I don't remember a damn thing that was said. I don't remember anything that was said. I remember following Urban introduced me to Paulie, who's my sponsor. He was from day one, and he still is today, and I followed him around like, you know, I heard this buzzwords, a sponsor, and, you know, steps, and I won a week, and I'm out of here with those, nothing there.
But this sponsor thing, and I felt like that little duck, you know. I walked up to him, I said, "Are you my sponsor?" And he said, "No, no, no." And he said to me, he said, "It's Tuesday, Jim." I said, "I know that. I even know what time it is, if you really want to know the truth." He said, "How about we go to a meeting on Friday? We'll get together the next few days for coffee, and Friday night we'll go to a meeting." And I looked at him and I said, isn't too much of a good thing bad for you? See, AA is the only place a guy like me can go who has failed at everything he's ever done in life, who has drank himself out of every relationship he's ever had, been a 50-yard dash man in a 100-yard race, a guy whose father says to him, "Son, you've been using my car for 3 weeks and the oil light's been on for 3 weeks. Do something about that oil light." And I say, "Okay," and I take a hammer and I break the oil light out. Did something about that oil light. A guy whose mother says, "Jimmy, you want to make $20? "Sure, Mom, what do I got to do?" "Paint the bedroom." "Okay, I'll paint the bedroom." Never moved a stick of furniture. Painted around all the dressers. A half-assed 50-yard dash man in a 100-yard race, okay? And yet, you know something? I go in Alcoholics Anonymous on my knees begging, "Please help me. I'll do anything. Tell me what you want me to do." Okay? And yet it's the only place a high school guy doesn't go to college on his first day and have all the answers. He knows he doesn't have the answers. A college person doesn't go into pre-med and know they have all, they know they don't know anything. Something about the newcomer comes to AA and has them all, baby, got all the answers. Bam, bam, just laying them out, you know, and that's us, ain't it, you know? Jesus. I'll be able to tell my sponsor how to live in short order here. I'll have this deal figured out. And you know what? I got a hunch one day he's going to ask the sponsor if I will sponsor him. That's how it's going to be. Maybe, you know. And I remember a comment once that Frank made to me. He said, "There was this guy in the beginners group," he said, "and he came up to me after the beginners meeting," Frank's telling me this, "and he says, you know, Frank, you forgot what it was like." And Frank looked at him and said, "You know something, kid? The reason I'm still here is because I never forgot what it was like. That's why I'm still here, because I never forgot what it was like. And if you got a brain in your head, you'll come back so that we can continue to remind you of what it was like. But I don't have that mentality when I'm new. I process direction in an entirely different fashion when I'm new in AA. It just is my nature. My sponsor says to me, Jim, I know you don't know if there's a God, but I want you to get on your knees every morning and every night, and I want you to pray. I process it this way. Jim, I know you might not think there's a God, but if you happen to wake up on time in the morning, and if you're not too tired after work at night, you might consider occasionally, if there is a God, asking him for help and thanking him. Jim, I want you to get a home group. I want you at the Monday night meeting, the Tuesday night meeting, the Thursday night meeting, whatever. And of course, I'm the whole time I'm like this. I process it, Jim, if Hogan's Heroes is not, and you happen to have the spare time, if you're not too busy in your wonderful life that you've created here in A&A, you might want to get to a meeting or two occasionally. I found out something. I found out to recover, I got to be present. I mean, I found that out years ago. To recover and to have the daily reprieve that is contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual conditioning, I got to be present. It isn't just going to happen with me kneeling down praying in my bedroom and meditating in the morning. I'm the only guy in AA history who's ever been told to stop meditating. He said, "I want you to start meditating." I said, "How do you meditate?" He says, "Just close your eyes and whatever happens, just let go with it, man, you know." And so, you know, I did that, and I'd get aroused because I'd see naked women. And I'd have to go up to the bathroom frequently after meditation. And I told my sponsor, Paul, I said, "Paul, you know, Jesus, every time I meditate, I get aroused." He says, "All right, stop." recovery, because now they're dressed when they meditate. So we went on the adventure, the journey. You know, I was told early on that I can go to an AA meeting every night and not get well. That's what I was told. They likened it to I can sit in a chicken coop every night and I'm never going to lay an egg. Okay? And I can go to an AA meeting every night and not get well. They told me I had to take some steps. They said there's a series of steps that you need to take, Jim, and if you don't take those steps, all you are going to be is an insane human being who isn't drinking. And, you know, I was this close to going over that line of no return. One day I read something that made it so clear to me. I was sitting with all the tough guys, you know, all hung over, and I read for whatever reason, I had a poster of Life magazine in my hand, and I read a caption in it that said, "There's nothing so tragic as when the human spirit dies before the body." And I broke into tears, big time, went to pieces. You know, I understood pretty well, as burned out as my brain was, why it was necessary to take steps. Because my human spirit can still die if God is not in the place of the emptiness I once carried in me. And I had no way to access that power. I had no way to tap into that power. And you know something? I could never have tapped into that power had the bondage of self not been lifted to a certain degree that made life tenable and livable. Had I not been able to alleviate or eliminate a lot of the guilt and a lot of the fear and a lot of the pain and a lot of the negatives that I had carried with me in my lifetime, I would have lived in darkness. But the problem was, it's hard to teach a doorknob, okay? It's hard to get a brick to do anything. And it took me a long, long time to even begin to consider. I acted like I wanted to take these actions, but you know, secretly, I just wasn't doing it. And finally, one day, my sponsor was a runner. He was a jogger. And I loved Paulie. I loved him then. I love him now. And there was something about him that I was so attracted to, his humility and his kindness. And I said, damn it, I got to figure out a way to hang out with this guy more, you know. And I was pretty new, and I was, you know, I was not a heavy smoker, maybe 3 packs a day, maybe a couple gallons of coffee. That's not bad when you're a newcomer. That's the average when you're a newcomer. You know, 2 gallons of coffee, 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and you're on your way to recovery. You know, 2 hours of sleep a night. What the hell? You don't have jobs. It doesn't matter. You know, it takes a couple of years to get to the point where you want to work. So I put on my black socks that go up to my knees. I didn't know what was hip. I wasn't a runner. I had these little skimpy ass shorts on and a bit of REOT Speedwagon T-shirt on, and I started to jog. I'd park my beat up truck down at Fricker's Fruit Stand right here. It's right down the street here. Right here. This is the street I ran on. In fact, this is the place I had my first sexual experience, was at this place. I'm not kidding you. CCD. I did it in CCD. I'm sorry. You want truth? Well, my wife doesn't hear this tape. She wasn't even alive yet. So I put on my running gear. Okay, and I say to myself, I'm going to start jogging because I'm going to be worthy. So I'd park my truck at Fricker's Fruit Stand. Okay? And I was like Robert Conrad, you know. I even had my cigarettes rolled up in my shirt like that. And I get down to the entrance of DeAndre's. This used to be DeAndre Seminary. And I'd stop and have a cigarette and puke, and then I'd run back. And I did that every day for about a week, and I showed up at Paulie's house one day, and I was just waiting for him to come out because I'm a jogger now. And he came out. We started jogging together, and the time came. You know, I wasn't quite ready to follow this guidance and direction crap, but I liked him. So time came for, he says to me, he says, you know, there's a race coming up. It's a 3-mile and a 6-mile race. I want you to do the 3-mile race. And I said, why not the 6-mile race? He said, because I don't think you're ready for the 6-mile race. And, of course, I laughed. You don't know who you're talking to, I thought to myself. He said that the race day came. I had my Kmart Trax running shoes on. I had my black socks and I was ready to rock. And we lined up, okay? Now, he was in the 6-mile race because he was superior in my mind, and that's why he was in the 6 and I was only in the 3. Not because he ran every day for the last 7 years. It had nothing to do with it. And we line up and I look around me and I see fat men, skinny men, old men, young men, fat women, thin women. I even spotted a pregnant woman, had to be 8 months pregnant. And I think to myself, oh, brother, there ought to be a law, I say to myself, you know. So Paulie comes up to me just before the start of the race, and he says to me, now listen, moron, he says, he didn't say that, but that's what I thought he said. My perception was still, he probably said, listen, Jimbo, you nice guy, you. He says, you're not going to win this race. And I sat, I didn't move my head. I didn't acknowledge his comment. And he said, I just want you to be able to finish this race. And my head began to shake up and down. As I thought to myself, he still doesn't know who I am. We line up for the race, the gun goes off. Boom! Man, I'm like a shot out of the gate. With no knowledge that you can't sprint for 3 miles. I had no knowledge of that. So like a bat out of hell, I'm taking off, and I got about 3/4 of a mile down the road, and I started getting one of them cramps in my side. And I thought, oh, Jesus. Ah, man. And some guys start passing me, and they're passing me. I thought, yeah, you know, 10th, 11th place, that isn't so bad. There's probably 250 people in this race. And then I'm slowing down a little bit more, and I get another cramp on my other side, and I feel my bowels starting to want to let go, you know. And pretty soon I'm running with a pinched butt thing going. And I'm starting to feel nauseous. I mean, because I was down to a pack a day by then, but I still wasn't really in prime condition. And I'm running, and I'm thinking, oh, God, 50th place. And then a little while later, 100th place. And then I'm thinking, Jesus, God, just not last place, okay? And so I'm telling you, I mean, everyone and their brother was just about past me. I heard very few footsteps behind me, but I said I was not going to be in last place. I'll die before I'm in last place. Not happening. By then, I'm cashed, you know, and I hear the last set of, one guy passed me, I hear the last set of footsteps behind me, and they're coming up, you know, coming up, and it's that pregnant lady. Pregnant lady passes me. And I finished. I walked in, I finished the race, and I sat down by a tree, and I puked, and I thought, for the very first time, and this is a true deal, I thought to myself, maybe he knows something I don't know. Maybe I ought to start listening to him a little more. Maybe it's time for me to become a little more teachable, because that was by far one of the most humiliating experiences of my life. And I did. I began to listen. I began to listen and do. I began to understand the concept that faith without works is dead. I began to understand that I have to act my way into recovery. I began to understand that maybe it's better to be a blind man who sees than a man who sees but is blind. I mean, I was a blind man, and I thought I had the answers, and I didn't have any. I thought I knew, and I didn't know. The world began to unveil itself to me when I started to listen, when I started to surrender, when I started to become teachable, and we moved on with those steps. And I had some absolutely remarkable experiences with those steps. I mean, you know, how willing do you have to be to get well, to write down everything you've ever done in your life to somebody or to the people in your life, every event, every negative, and then confess that to another human being? You have to be pretty willing. How willing do you have to be to make up a list of all the things that you dislike about yourself and humbly, humbly ask God to remove those shortcomings? How willing do you have to be to write out a list of all the people, most of whom we love the most, that we have harmed in our lives, and have the courage and fortitude to go to those people with courage and look them in the eye and tell them we're sorry? You have to be pretty willing. You know, the 9th step I took with my father was probably one of the most profound experiences of my lifetime. We always had a negative electricity between us, you know. And I didn't think that would ever go away. And I did my 9th step with him, and I don't know how I did it, because I was so scared. I knew I couldn't do it. And one day I was in his presence, and it just happened. I mean, stuff just happens if you put yourself in the right path. And I found myself looking my dad in the eye, a man who's never said, I love you, son. I found myself looking my dad in the eye and saying to him, you know something? I hurt you for a lot of years. And I never told my dad I loved him. Never. I said, I want you to know that I never meant to harm you, that I was so sick, that you were a father who did the best he could do with a son who was totally out of control, and that I love you. That's miraculous, to say that to someone who you just could never say it to. And to be able to do that with a whole series of people is a phenomenal event. I don't think I realize the miracle half the time, you know? I really don't. I wonder. But I think the longer that I'm sober, the more I begin to see the miracle. The more I begin to see the phenomenal effects that Alcoholics Anonymous has on my life and the lives of the people around me. There was an experience I had that I share several months ago. I'm the kind of guy who was never going to have a wife, and I was never going to have a kid. It was just, it could happen to you, but it was never going to happen to me. It was never going to happen for me. And, of course, one day she came along, and my wife, Emily, who's a wonderful lady, and we got married, and one day we were blessed with a miracle of a little girl. I mean, the most beautiful little thing that I ever laid my eyes on in my life. And I thought it was going to be a boy. You know, I thought, I don't have female eggs in me or whatever it is that makes the babies. It's going to be a boy. I wouldn't have anything but boys. And it was a little girl, and I said, the first words, she pushed, and she pushed, and she pushed, and she was in the middle of labor, pushing, and pushing. And Jesus, sweat's rolling off her head, and I'm like, oh, go, push, go. The phone rings. I pick it up. It's Billy Mastro. He says, hey, how's it going? I said, you have the worst timing, and I just hung up. She's pushing, pushing, she's pushing. Finally, the baby comes out. Baby comes out, this beautiful little girl, and I said, doctor, this boy has no penis. No one laughed. No, no one. No one thought that was funny. But the remarkable thing about it was the next words were, I bent over to my wife, and I didn't plan this. I said, you know something? I said, you did a wonderful job, and if I wasn't sober, this never would have happened. Never would have happened. And what I've discovered since that child is born, aside from the fact that she pees backwards, what I have discovered is alcoholism has the ability to make me miss life. Alcoholism has the ability to make me miss life. The nature of the beast within me is self-centeredness. It is self-centeredness. It's all about me, unless I'm very careful. And one day, you know, we had some big business problems occur, and I had some health issues occur, and we were in the midst of these big business issues, and I was driving my daughter, Megan, you know, from my lovely home that I never should have had and never would have had, driving in my nice car with my beautiful daughter, all things I never was supposed to get, over to the parents' home who disowned me 16 years ago, who I didn't think I'd ever have a relationship with again. And we go into the house, and I take Megan's hat and coat off, and I sit down on the couch, and she runs to Grandma and Grandpa, and as I sit in morbid reflection of the horrors of life, the music starts playing. Okay, I hear the piano music start playing. And the music starts playing. And I look up. And my mom's on one side. And my dad's on the other side. And my daughter's in the middle. And they're sitting at the piano playing songs and singing together. And I thought, you asshole. How dare you? How dare you not appreciate the gifts God has given you because of a few bumps in the road. I almost missed the movie. You know, I come this close to missing the movie. AA's teaching me not to miss the movie. You know what else it's teaching me? Words like love and responsibility are just fine, but doing them is an entirely different thing. Compassion's a nice word, but being compassionate is an entirely different thing. I said in a meeting the other night, AA has taught me how to love, really love, like an adult. most of the time. AA has taught me not only to be compassionate, but to act on compassion. AA has taught me how to want to give rather than receive. The most profound prayer I've ever read is the St. Francis prayer. If I could be that prayer, I would be whole. I'm human. I'm not going to be that prayer, but I'm going to try. I'm going to end with a couple of thoughts. Table Rock Lake, Missouri, 4 years sober. 4 years sober, and I'm out fishing, and a storm blows in. And my boat's filling with water. I've been lost now for 4 hours. I'm running out of gas. My gas tanks are bobbing. Okay? I peed in my pants. Hyperthermia was beginning to set in. I am pissed. I am bailing my boat, and as I'm bailing the boat, I'm saying, why are you doing this to me, God? Why? I've been sober 4 years. I work with newcomers. I read the damn book. I pray. I go to meetings. The deal was this. I found shore. I found land. And the reality was, God was not going to come down and bail the boat. Okay? It was okay to not be okay. And it's okay to not be okay. Today. But it's not okay to not do something about it. Because if I don't bail the boat, I'm going to drown. No one's going to bail it for me. It's not up to anyone else. It's up to me. I bailed. He directed. I didn't believe, but he directed. The Poseidon Adventure. Anybody see that movie? Okay? The minister says, as the boat is sinking, kneel down and pray. The other minister says, pray while you're running the hell out of here. Okay? Take the action. Take the action. Give of self, even when it's contrary to your nature, Jim, and maybe someday it won't be, because it's going to save your life. It's going to save your life. And sometimes we get into a mode, you know, where we work with people and they get drunk. And then we work with some more and they get drunk. The first 10 guys I sponsored got drunk. I thought maybe they were going to ban me from sponsorship in AA. Call the central office and put my poster up somewhere, you know. Going to AA meetings, don't let this guy sponsor you. You know? But I stayed sober. I was here. I stayed here. And we wonder if we touch lives. We wonder if we touch lives. Lori, I read this in that, what's that book called? Chicken Vet. I read this thing in that book. It's about a man is walking along the beach, a tourist, and he looks down the beach at low tide, and he sees a little figure way down there walking, bending over, throwing something into the ocean, walking, bending over, throwing something in the ocean. Finally, he approaches this guy, and he says to him, what are you doing? And the guy says, it's low tide, and all these starfish are up on shore, and they're all going to die. You know, throw someone back in the ocean. The other guy said, you know, there must be hundreds of thousands of them up and down this coastline. You're not possibly going to make a difference. The guy bent down, threw it in the ocean. He said, it's going to make a difference to that one. Make a difference to that one. You never know what a kind word or a kind gesture is going to do for the next drunk that walks into your meeting. I'm going to make sure that I'm one of the guys that has his hand out for that guy and that woman, because we don't know how we touch them, and we may never know, but we know we'll stay here if we try to touch them. Thanks, that's all I got.